This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown, reporting by remote. Ahead of the G7 summit in Britain, U.S. President Joe Biden formally announcing his administration is donating 500 million doses of the Pfizer vaccine for 92 low- and middle-income countries. Biden said Thursday the donation, which was first announced on Wednesday, will be made with no strings attached. The U.S. president's announcement comes a day before the start of the G7 summit, meeting of the world's most advanced democracies in Cornwall. Biden said on Friday, G7 nations will be announcing the full scope of the commitment. Prior to his vaccine announcement, Biden met Thursday with Prime Minister Boris Johnson, agreeing on a new Atlantic charter modeled on the statement made by then British Prime Minister Winston Churchill and then U.S. President Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1941 to promote democracy and free trade. French President Emmanuel Macron welcomed as great news the decision by the U.S. to donate the 500 million doses of COVID-19 vaccines to the poorest countries and said Europe should do the same. France was the first rich country to donate via COVAX, sending 100,000 doses to Mauritania in April, and Macron said the country would donate a 500,000 doses by mid-June and 30 million doses by the end of the year. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says there will be further study on reports of heart inflammation in young men and teens who have gotten the COVID vaccination. Officials say the reports are rare, and it's not yet clear if the heart inflammation they're seeing in males ages 16 to 24 is being caused by the shots. Most of the patients have fully recovered. For more news, please join us at voanews.com. This is VOA News. The United States may soon look to regulate private companies, mandating higher standards for cybersecurity following a series of damaging hacks and ransomware attacks against key firms and critical infrastructure. President Biden's nominees to fill two top cyber roles in his administration warned Thursday that malign actors are currently operating with impunity and that too many private sector organizations have so far failed to take the necessary precautions. Earlier this week, the chief executive of Colonial Pipeline, the largest fuel pipeline operator here in the United States, told lawmakers in Washington he felt he had no choice but to pay close to $5 million to the DarkSide Network following a ransomware attack in May that caused fuel delivery disruptions up and down the country's eastern coast. Russian authorities have ordered Facebook and the messaging app Telegram to pay steep fines for failing to remove banned content. A Moscow court fined Facebook a total of $236,000 in Telegram, $139,000. Early this year, Russia's state communications watchdog started slowing down Twitter and threatened it would ban over alleged failure to take down unlawful content. The crackdown unfolded after authorities criticized social media platforms to have brought tens of thousands of people into the streets across Russia this year to demand the release of jailed Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. The U.S. is condemning Nigeria's ongoing ban of Twitter in the country, saying the action has no place in a democracy. Last weekend, the U.S. joined the European Union, Britain, Ireland, and Canada in criticizing Nigeria's action. The Abuja government indefinitely banned Twitter after the U.S. social media company deleted a tweet from President Muhammadu Buhari's account for violating its rules. Buhari's tweet referred to the country's civil war 4 decades ago and a warning about recent unrest referring to those misbehaving in violence in the southeastern part of the country. Officials there blamed the prohibited separatist group IPOB for attacks on police and election offices. Buhari's office denied the Twitter suspension was a response to the removal of that post. As always, for details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website, VOAnews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown reporting by remote, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Money Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, June 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenya unveils its 2021-22 fiscal year budget, prominently featuring the COVID-19 pandemic.
In order to facilitate further rollout of vaccines to create herd immunity, we propose to allocate Kenya shilling 14.3 billion in the financial 2021-22. This is in addition to Kenya shilling 7.6 billion appropriated in the current budget.
A Zambian opposition leader says he will campaign for incumbent President Edgar Lungu in the August 12th presidential campaign. Nigeria's Kano State says it has put together measures to prevent student abductions. The potential impact of lifting a long-game moratorium in Guinea-Bissau, and Somalia denies its troops have been fighting in Ethiopia's Tigray conflict.
Speaking at a news briefing Thursday, Minister for Information Usman Dube said there are no Somali troops inside the troubled region, nor in the northern region of Tigray or in the ancient city of Aksum.
And UN agencies said 160 million of the world's children are forced to work. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Kenyan government on Thursday released its 2021-22 fiscal year budget, totaling $366 billion. It will become effective July 1st. This is the second budget since the onset of the coronavirus pandemic, and appropriately so, health is among three government ministries with the largest allocations. As Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi, the budget is the balance of win and lose because of both tax exemptions and new import taxes.
Presenting the 2021-2022 budget from the Parliament building yesterday, Thursday, Treasury Cabinet Secretary Ukur Yatani said the government has proposed the allocation of $143 million to facilitate the rollout of COVID-19 vaccines across the country and create herd immunity. This in addition to $76 million appropriated in the 2020-2021 budget. Yatani said this year's budget largely revolves around the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic and its containment measures.
In March 2021, the government launched the National COVID-19 Vaccination Program, initially targeting the frontline workers and other highly vulnerable groups. As at end of May 2021, about 1 million persons had received the first vaccine dose. In order to facilitate further rollout of vaccines to create herd immunity, we propose to allocate Kenya shilling 14.3 billion in the financial 2021-22. This is in addition to Kenya shilling 7.6 billion appropriated in the current budget.
The 2021-2022 budget is the largest in Kenyan history, as well as the whole of East Africa region. It is up from $284 billion in the previous budget. Economic expert Charles Karisa says the major challenge for the government is finding ideal ways to finance the budget.
The biggest challenge in this year's budget is that we need to look at ways on how to finance the budget, because 3.6 trillion budget is really one of the biggest in our region, and therefore the challenge is to see how to finance it. We look at the Kenya Revenue Authority, that in the past have only been able to collect more than 2 trillion, meaning therefore we'll have about 900 billion as a deficit. So I think there are only two options. Option number one is to tax people so that they're able to raise revenue. The other option is to borrow locally, what you call domestic borrowing. And then we also have what you call a foreign borrowing.
According to financial reports, Kenya's public debt stood at $73 billion by the end of 2020, representing an estimated 69% of gross domestic product GDP. Because of rising budget deficits throughout the years to finance infrastructure projects, this has caused uproars among a section of Kenyans. Opio Wandayi, a member of the National Assembly, says it is important for the government to live within its means and avoid unnecessary borrowing.
Those figures that we keep flaunting of trillions really make no sense unless and until we know the source of the money. We must, as a country, learn to live within our means. And there's no point being too ambitious when we know the reality is that there's no money. If we are to finance such budget, we have to continue borrowing more and more, both locally and from foreign sources, which is going to be unsustainable.
Following the government's ban on charcoal, According to statistics, about 53% of Kenyans, mostly in urban areas, use liquefied petroleum gas, LPG, as cooking fuel. Now the government has imposed a 16% value-added tax on liquefied petroleum gas. It was previously exempted, and it is a blow to most Kenyans. George Kimani owns a restaurant business in Nairobi, which uses LPG gas for cooking. He says 16% increase in the price of the fuel will drastically affect his profit.
The move by the government to add taxation to gas is going to affect most of us, especially us who are into the food kiosk businesses and restaurants, because initially the tax on gas was at 0%, but now that the tax is at 16%, it means the prices are going to go high, and we cannot add the prices of the commodities we sell to our customers unless it is well communicated to them. So it is going to affect our businesses, and it is going to affect the profits we get.
According to the Auditor General, almost 30% of Kenya's budget ends up squandered through corruption. In efforts to curb this, a budget of $65 million has been allocated to the Ethics and Anti-Corruption Commission and the Director of Public Prosecution to help fight the vice. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
Somalia's Ministry of Information has denied reports that Somali troops training in Eritrea fought in Ethiopia's war in Tigray. The rejection came as parents of missing troops held another protest demanding to know their whereabouts. Mohamed Kahir reports from Mogadishu.
The federal government of Somalia has strongly rejected a report by the UN Human Rights Council this week that said thousands of Somali troops have taken part in Ethiopia's Tigray conflict. Speaking at a news briefing Thursday, Minister for Information Osman Dube said there are no Somali troops inside the troubled region. He says there are no Somali troops fighting in Ethiopia, nor in the northern region of Tigray, or in the ancient city of Aksum. Some parents of the Somali soldiers in the army say their sons are missing and have demonstrated in Mogadishu, demanding answers and vowing they will continue to protest until the president speaks up. This parent of a soldier says the government took our children to Eritrea to take part in fighting in Tigray region. He said, if the government does not bring them back home, we will continue our demonstrations in the city and close down major roads. According to political analyst Dahir Koro, the government and the opposition are trying to divert the public's attention from key issues ahead of upcoming elections.
All these circumstances of the claims and counterclaims, it's important mentioning that important service delivery to the Somali populations are being missed. This is just a way of creating confusion. Government is not also substantiating these claims about the troops. They are not providing either independent media or the Somali media, spaces.
Somalia is scheduled to hold its already delayed presidential and parliamentary elections before August. Mohamed Kaye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
The leader of Zambia's opposition Green Party said his party is embarking on a nationwide campaign tour to boost President Edgar Lungu's re-election bid in the August 12 general election. Peter Sinkamba recently endorsed President Lungu at a news conference in the capital, Lusaka. But the move is drawing sharp criticism from some who accuse Sinkamba of appearing to be an opposition figure in name while doing the bidding of President Lungu and his ruling Patriotic Front Party. VOA's Peter Clotty reached Green Party's Peter Sinkamba in the country's Copper Belt region to learn more about his decision to campaign for President Lungu.
We did go into the support endorsing Edgar Lungu as presidential candidate to try and marshal the necessary numbers so that he's able to win the elections in August. We embarked on the campaign to mobilize our people across the country to vote for him.
Why endorse the president and embark on a nationwide campaign tour for his re-election bid, particularly when all forms of rallies appear to have been barred by the Electoral Commission of Zambia?
What we are doing is that we are working within the guidelines which were given by the Electoral Commission of Zambia to engage in the campaigns, not using rallies, but other means. And we what we saw in Northwestern Province, where we launched our campaign yesterday is that it's working out very, very well because we've sent foot soldiers to go and reach out in all areas.
Are you embarking on a door-to-door campaign as part of this effort you are embarking on?
We are approaching it from two ways. One, door-to-door campaign. Number two, through the cooperatives that we have. We have got agricultural cooperatives across the country in all provinces, all districts that have been set up to cultivate cannabis and hemp for industrial and medical purposes. So we are using those as our sales for disseminating the message to vote for ECL.
What do you say to some of your critics who are of the view that you are just an opposition figure in name only because you just endorsed the president a few weeks ahead of the election and that you have been paid to do just this in time for the elections?
Well, we are the only opposition party in the last 30 years to move bills in parliament and they are enacted into law. The industrial hemp bill and the cannabis bill, which have now become acts of parliament. And what we have proven to the world by also doing this time around, to have our bills enacted in parliament, is that you can work aggressively to move your agenda without even being in parliament, provided you have a working relationship with the people that are in government. And the PF has demonstrated that if you are an opposition party with a genuine agenda, they're able to adopt it and implement it. And unfortunately, those critics have nothing to offer to the nation. That's why they are criticizing us. But otherwise, we are the only party with an agenda which is going to bring in billions of dollars into the country, and we're happy about it.
What is your core message to the people of Zambia as you embark on this campaign tour for which you think Zambians should vote for President Lungu?
The Green Party agenda, which is legalization of cannabis, is the only agenda which can help dismantle the debt of this country. The debt of this country is about $17 billion, and we are able to generate that kind of money within a couple of years or so to dismantle the entire debt. Hakainde Hichilema has failed to come up with any solution for debt dismantling.
Peter Sinkamba is leader of Zambia's opposition Green Party. You are speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, June 11. The Kano State Government in northwest Nigeria says it has put in place security and preventive measures to stop the abduction of students. Mohamed Seydou Sanusi is the Kano State Commissioner of Education. He spoke with reporter Mike Umboyan about the security measures, which he says include sending students from closed facilities to schools in the cities.
First, consistent prayer. Secondly, we have been very proactive. I came up with a proposal that all schools at border local governments, all schools, especially border schools within a major highways, were closed down. And His Excellency accepted the proposal. We have schools, border schools, that is in border local government with Kaduna State. Some with Jigawa, some with Katsina. So all these border schools, we closed them down.
What happened to the students of the schools that were closed?
We concentrated in relocating the students to urban areas where we feel they are secured, where we feel even if there is this attack, they will even not have the opportunity of traveling with the children for a long distance. But if you allow a school that is on a highway, so it's very easy, you know, to convey the students and travel away with them. So these are some of the active measures we put in place. And now, any school, any boarding school that is not well fenced, we also have to close that down, that school, pending when we are going to provide perimeter fencing for the school and other internal security measures. But I assure you that the boarding schools we are having now, we have put in place a lot of security measures, which, you know, we cannot disclose in the media. So to say.
That was Mohamed Seydou Sanusi, Commissioner of Education for Nigeria's Kano State. You are speaking with reporter Michael Boyan from Kano, northwestern Nigeria. The potential lifting of the current logging moratorium in Guinea-Bissau could lead to an acceleration of illicit logging activities in the country, says Lucia Bird Ruiz Benitez de Lugo. She is the author of a new report by Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime. She tells Ricky Schreier that illicit logging has already increased since the government changed last year in Guinea-Bissau.
And a number of community members really expressed fears that we would see a return to the uncontrolled logging we saw between 2012 and 2014, and partly also that the legalization of some timber exports would make it easier to export illicitly felled wood, including, for example, the rosewood species, which is listed by CITES, the Convention on International Trade Endangered Species of Fauna and Flora, which would be disguised among the legal shipments. The government has said that if the moratorium is lifted, the logging sector will be closely regulated, but there is limitations to the capacity in doing that, even if there is political will.
In regards to political will, current Prime Minister Nuno Nabiam is under investigation by the judicial police, along with some business leaders from China and some other high-level political authorities for illicit logging. How does that impact the current discussion of the moratorium and the, you know, potential future of what logging looks like in the country?
Well, the illicit logging market, like other illicit markets in Guinea-Bissau, certainly involves the interests of high-level members of state and high levels of the state infrastructure. As you've highlighted and became clear from a judicial police investigation coming from a seizure in late 2020, the current Prime Minister Nabiam is under investigation for his alleged involvement in the sector, which is widely reported in the press. It's clear that where there are high-level interests at play, these may well shape the approach taken by the government to the logging sector and perhaps could be playing a role in the reported pending lifting of the moratorium.
According to your timetable, the illicit logging activities reached, quote, unprecedented levels. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what those levels look like?
We definitely saw a really steep spike in illicit logging activity in 2012. As you say, the military junta took power and the logging sector became a key sector from which they drew revenues to fund their activities, to pay salaries, etc. And we saw a huge spike. So according to reports by the Environmental Investigation Agency, timber exports from Guinea-Bissau to China alone reached 98,000 tons in 2014. That's the equivalent of over 250,000 trees. And across that period, right in the middle in 2013, Chatham House estimated that 80% of logging in the country was illicit. So it was a very rapid expansion of the industry. It benefited those in power, although it's very difficult to know what the illicit logging market would look like were the moratorium to be lifted. Both civil society and community members expressed fears that we would see a similar surge once more.
That was Lucia Bird Ruiz Benitez de Luga, author of a new report by Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from London. A new report finds that 160 million children, or nearly one child in 10, is involved in child labor globally, an increase of 8.4 million since 2016. A joint report by the International Labour Organization and the UN Children's Fund says the COVID-19 pandemic is worsening an already alarming situation. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the report is being launched in advance of the World Day Against Child Labour on June 12.
This is the first increase recorded in absolute numbers since the International Labour Organization began tracking the extent of child labour globally 20 years ago. The data show nearly half of these children, or 79 million, are involved in hazardous work, 6.5 million more than in 2016. Hazardous work is considered as among the worst forms of child labour. It is dangerous, harmful to a child's physical and mental health, and could result result in death. The ILO reports 70% of children work in agriculture, most on family farms, 20% in services including domestic work, and 10% in industry. The picture that emerges from this study varies by region. The report finds child labor is continuing to decrease in Asia and the Pacific, as well as in Latin America and the Caribbean. However, child labor has risen substantially in Africa and sub-Saharan Africa. ILO Director General Guy Ryder says in Africa as a whole, 20 million more children are in child labor today than they were 4 years ago. Of those, he says 16.6 million are in sub-Saharan Africa.
So if you look at that in percentage terms, it means that almost one in five African children are in child labor, one in four in the sub-Saharan sub-region. They're losing out on their education, they're working at a young age, they're working too many hours, they are often working in hazardous occupations.
Executive Director of UNICEF, Henrietta Fore, expresses concern at the alarming rise in younger children who are toiling in child labor. She says half of all children in child labor around the world are aged 5 to 11 years. She says the COVID-19 pandemic is making this terrible situation even worse.
Faced with job losses and rising poverty, families are forced to make heartbreaking decisions. We estimate that 9 million more children could be pushed into child labor by the end of next year.
To reverse the upward trend in child labor, the ILO and UNICEF are calling for adequate social protection for all, including universal child benefits, and for quality education and increased spending in getting children back to school. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with Ajax of Netherlands goalkeeper and Cameroon international Andre Onana, who has had his ban for a positive doping test cut to 9 months on Thursday and can resume playing in November. The Court of Arbitration for Sport said its judges found Onana was not at significant fault and reduced his one-year ban by UEFA. The ban now ends on November the 3rd. The ruling could see Arsenal step up its reported interest in signing the 25-year-old Onana, who is cleared to play for Cameroon at the African Cup of Nations in January. Onana tested positive last October for a banned diuretic, often used as a masking agent to hide the presence of other drugs. In Egypt, Al Hakli announced on Thursday that the Court of Arbitration for Sports rejected the appeal of Etoile du Sahel's Ivorian striker Soleimani Koulibaly regarding the $1.4 million fine he has to pay after breaching a 3.5-year deal with Al Hakli. FIFA ordered Koulibaly in 2019 to pay a $1.4 million fine to Al Hakli after the latter lodged a complaint with the world governing body against the player, who left the club in the summer of 2017. The Ivorian striker joined Al Hakli from Scottish side Kilmarnock in January 2017 on a 3.5-year deal. However, he left the club 5 months later, explaining his acrimonious exit by saying he had received a slave's treatment at the club. Staying with football news, Football Kenya Federation has launched the Nairobi Women's Regional League that kicked off at the Ligi Ndogo grounds over the weekend. Football Kenya Federation Vice President Doris Petra says the winners of the league will be guaranteed promotion to the second-tier Women Division 1 League. Vice President Doris Petra has also decried the near inadequate number of women football coaches in Kenya.
We need to get more ladies coming to train as coaches, going through and coming up, because we have a problem when it comes to lady women coaches in this country.
In athletics, Team Kenya athletes currently in bubble camps at the Kasarani Stadium are the first batch of athletes to receive the second dose of the AstraZeneca vaccine in the second phase of the rollout campaign by the Ministry of Sports and Ministry of Health. The bubble camp in Kasarani currently has the Kenya Rugby Sevens men's team, the Shujaa, the Rugby Sevens women's team, the Lionesses, the volleyball team, Malkia Strikers, the Boxers, and the Taekwondo athletes. They will be joined by the athletics team once their qualifiers are done. Kenya's Sports Cabinet Secretary Amina Mohamed speaks on the second phase of vaccination ahead of the Olympic Games.
We had vaccinated all our athletes, Before, and he's been very, very kind and has provided 2,000 vaccinations, and so we have started.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, June 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.